Book 2, Chapter 6, Cana. Whilst Jesus was staying in Cana, probably in Nathanael's house, a wedding was in progress in the town, and he was invited with the disciples to the feast. It may have been a courteous invitation to a visiting rabbi, but more probably the request was for the more intimate reason that a relative of Jesus was being married. Mary was there, and her subsequent concern and instructions to the servants argue a near relationship. That no mention is made of Joseph may suggest that Mary was now a widow. The marriage ceremony in Palestine at the time was a much more solemn occasion than we are accustomed to in our modern Western civilization. It lasted for several days and was preceded by a fast. The pious Jew considered it essentially a religious occasion and looked upon it as the symbol of the union of God with Israel. He believed that his past sins were forgiven, and after a feast which, though joyful, was almost sacramental in character, he began a new life. It was in such an atmosphere, heightened by the presence of Jesus, that the feast began. The formal blessing was bestowed, the bridal cup was emptied, and the meal proceeded. Quite suddenly a difficult emergency arose. The wine had failed. This was a humiliation for the bridegroom, almost amounting to disgrace. The wine was his gift to his guests. The servants were the first to realize what had happened, but Mary, characteristically sensitive, was quick to feel something was wrong, and, ascertaining the reason, she whispered urgently to Jesus, "They have no wine." Mary's appeal was natural enough. During the years at Nazareth, Jesus had been more than adequate to deal with any situation that arose in the home or in the workshop. Mary had learned to appeal to him in moments of perplexity. She had absolute confidence in him. So now she expected him to intervene successfully. What she had heard from the enthusiastic disciples of the events in the Jordan Valley had increased her confidence and possibly heightened her expectation. Moreover, it is probable that the last-minute invitation of Jesus with his disciples was partly responsible for the crisis. The reply of Jesus must have startled and perplexed his mother. "Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come." There is no harshness in the appellation woman. It was often used in expressions of courtesy and reverence, and indeed Jesus was to utter it again when he looked down upon his mother in tender solicitude from the cross. But there can be no escape from the fact that Jesus was firmly refusing to allow her relationship to direct his actions, in spite of the deep mutual love behind it. It was very natural that, with the passing years and the human intimacies of home life, Mary had to learn again a lesson she had only partially learned 18 years before. The man of 30 had to repeat in these words the lesson the boy of 12 had taught in the temple. "Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business?" With a gentle relentlessness, which was to characterize all his teaching concerning human relationships, Jesus was telling his mother that the days of Nazareth were over forever. He was saying farewell to all his earthly ties. Mary had lost her son. Jesus had lost his mother. No longer could it be "my mother and I." Henceforth it must always be "my father and I." Jesus does not fail Mary, but he makes it clear that his actions will always be independent of the slightest human attempt to influence them. They will be the holy submission of a son to his father. The crisis will be averted, the feast will proceed joyfully, not because of the pleading of a woman or the honor of a bridegroom, but to manifest the glory of the Son. What did Jesus mean by those words, "Mine hour is not yet come"? Possibly Mary, stirred up by the glowing account of John's declaration from the lips of the disciples, was preoccupied by the angelic promise concerning the Messiah's destiny. Like the apostles, she expected the establishment of the kingdom in all its glory at the hands of her Son. Perhaps, too, she overlooked the humiliation and suffering to which John the Baptist, with deeper understanding, had alluded. She may have felt that his hour had come. Truly that hour would come, when Jerusalem would be holy, and the mountains would drop down new wine, and the hills flow with milk. But before that could be possible, there was another hour, the hour of death and glorification, when the Son of God would, by his blood, cleanse those who believe on him, and make possible eternal life to those who eat his flesh and drink his blood. To this hour Jesus referred throughout his ministry until, in the upper room at Jerusalem, he announced its arrival to those whom his Father had given him. "Father, the hour is come. Glorify thy Son." Mary, conscious of the sword that pierced her heart, yet without the slightest bitterness, expressed her undiminished confidence in Jesus. "Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it." 6 large jars, used for the ceremony ablutions, were ranged along the wall. Jesus gave instructions. "Fill the water pots with water." When each jar was filled to the brim, the servants looked expectantly at Jesus. "Draw out now and bear unto the steward of the feast." The steward, knowing nothing of the crisis or the miracle, expressed his gratification at the quality of the wine, and marveled that the best had been thus held in reserve. "This beginning of miracles," said the evangelist, "did Jesus in Cana of Galilee, and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him." It was the first of 8 miracles that John recorded, but unlike the other gospel writers, he always called them signs, thus using a word specially designed to call the attention of the readers to the deeper significance that lay beyond the physical event. This distinction compels our more careful scrutiny. We recognize the importance of the first occasion on which Jesus used the power his Father had bestowed upon him to give authority to his words. We rejoice in the picture of the Son of God mingling with the children of men, walking with them in their shadowed human paths, and teaching them that joy is the fruit of the Spirit as well as of the vine. But we are led further than this. We see Jesus changing the water of ceremonial cleansing into the wine of the new covenant. The steward of the feast was the servant of the father of the bridegroom, who was responsible for the purification and the sustenance of the guests. In him, we are able to distinguish the features of the high priest of Israel, who, presented with the new wine, did not know whence it came or who presented it, yet unconsciously acknowledged it as better than the old. "It is expedient for us," he says, "that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not." It was not the earthly bridegroom who had held back the good wine until now. It was the God of Israel who, in the fullness of time, sent forth the heavenly bridegroom with the true wine which had in it the essence of eternal life, before which the old wine is ready to vanish away. Although the steward did not know, the servants knew, because they listened to his words. And knowing, they wondered. But it was to the disciples that Christ's glory was manifested. His power was a vital confirmation to them of the truth of his words, and removed the last tendency to withhold their allegiance. Previously they had believed his claims, now he had vindicated them, and their mental assent became a personal trust and prepared them for that moment when, without hesitation, they would leave all and follow him.